Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's been one of the big mysteries of the long economic expansion we've seen since the Great Recession ended in 2009. Profits rose, unemployment went down to rock bottom, but wages didn't rise the way economists say they are supposed to in a free market capitalist system. Well, a new report takes a look at the long arc of employer-employee relations in this country and why workers' share of the American bounty drops even as the economy grows. This hour on Point, wages, workers, and the American economy. And you can join us. Are there jobs aplenty in your line of work? And have your wages risen in recent years or stayed level? What are you seeing in your community? Does it match what economists say we should be seeing when unemployment is at just a low 3.7%? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And a little later this hour, we'll also explore why more elderly workers than ever are staying on the job. We'll speak to an 80-year-old in Oklahoma who tells us why he can't retire. But first, joining us from Washington is Heidi Shierholz, senior economist and director of policy at the Economic Policy Institute. She served as a chief economist at the Department of Labor in the Obama administration. And she and colleague Josh Bivens are out with a new report about how employees have lost bargaining power over the years. Heidi, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Let's start with sort of a little bit of sort of economics 101. Why is it that the theory holds that when unemployment drops, you know, down to the levels we're seeing now, that wages should rise? What's the theory behind that?
You know, economists have some really complicated models to explain that, but the logic is exactly what any person on the street would think it would be. It is simply if your employer knows that there are outside options for you, that you could, if they're not treating you well, that you could quit the job you're in and take a job across the street for decent wages, then that employer actually has to pay you decent wages too. So when the labor market is tight, when the unemployment rate is low, that shifts leverage to workers. Employers just have to pay bigger wage increases to get and keep the workers that they need. Mm.
Well, and in fact, I was looking at wage reports from October. And in October, we did see wages rising at just over roughly 3% on average, outpacing what had been estimated for that time period. So are we not seeing the effects of the low unemployment now on wages?
Yes, I think we're starting to. So the economists have been talking for a very long time now because the unemployment rate has been very low for a while now. It's been at 4% or lower since April. And there's been this question of why those dynamics we just discussed of a low unemployment rate should be spurring stronger wage growth. Why aren't we seeing that? We are starting now, I believe, to see nascent signs of that. So that's very, very good news for workers. But it is this question of why on earth did it take an unemployment rate this low, 3.7%, before we started to see some, you know, like early signs of wage growth showing some life. And I have some theories about why that is,
and
if you want to get into that.
I absolutely do want to get into those here. But just to sort of give us a historical perspective first for a moment, I just want to know how far out of line is this sort of lagging wage growth that we've been seeing since 2009 with other economic recoveries we've had in the past.
It's very out of line. Okay. In the modern period, the other period where we saw labor markets were tight like what we're seeing now was in the late 90s, and then sort of from 1995 to 2000, the labor market got very, very tight before the recession of early 2000 hit. That was the recession before the Great Recession. Mm-hmm. But so in the late 90s, we saw labor markets getting tighter and tighter and tighter, like we're seeing now. And wage growth was much, much higher than it was now. Wage growth for low-income workers, wage growth for middle-income workers, wage growth for high-income workers. It was just stronger across the board than what we're seeing now. So what we're seeing now really is, it really has posed this puzzle that economists have spent a lot of time thinking about what's going on.
Okay, so this is worth diving into more deeply then. And you've done exactly that in this recent report that you co-wrote. What would you say is the primary driver? And there are lots of reasons why. We'll get to a bunch of them. But what is the primary driver for this decoupling?
I think, so one of the things I would say is I don't think that there has been an actual decoupling. What I think has happened is, as we talked about, low unemployment rates, a strong labor market shifts leverage to workers because then their employers know they have to pay them more money or the employee could just quit and take a better job somewhere else. So the tight labor market shifts leverage to workers. But here's the key. Leverage or bargaining power is in a very important sense cumulative. Mm. And so it's not just tight labor markets that workers need for securing stronger wage growth. It's also the whole other host of things that provide workers with economic leverage or bargaining power, things like strong unions, strong labor standards and their enforcement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, those kinds of things that are more policy oriented. And what we've seen in the last four decades is and particularly it's since this period of strong labor markets in the late 90s, where we did see stronger wage growth, what we've seen is this sort of systematic breaking down of those things, yeah, like unions, like strong labor standards that provided workers with bargaining power aside from the tight labor market. So when you have the decimation of other things that provide workers with bargaining power, then it takes a lower and lower and lower unemployment rate for the tight labor markets to spur strong wage growth. So I think the link is still there. Tight labor markets do spur strong wage growth, but because other sources of workers' bargaining power have been so decimated in recent decades, it just takes a tighter labor market than ever before to actually see that happening.
So what you're saying is the sparkling purity of economic theory doesn't really apply in the real world when we have all of these other policies that are playing important roles here.
Fair point. You could say that in any radio show about economics.
And I think in every single one we do.
Yes.
But just to get a little bit of a deeper sense here of what you're getting at, because I look, my first response to your paper was we've seen, for example, union membership on this continuous decline for what, the past 30 years. So so why? And you're talking about collective bargaining, et cetera, as being important forces that provide that labor leverage that workers ought to have. But why, but this is a decades long trend. Why is it that it's taken so long for us to see, as you're saying, maybe we have seen its effects in other ways, but this period now being under special consideration?
I think that the only thing that's different now is the fact that, the tight labor market that we're having now is unusual. We don't spend a lot of time in the sort of arc of the decades in our economy. We don't spend a ton of time where the unemployment rate is at 4% or less. So that's the thing that's different now, and that's the thing that's making people go, wait, why is this not delivering stronger wage growth for workers? We have this unusual thing that's happening right now that's great. Jobs are pretty plentiful, but the other thing that really matters to workers is not just whether jobs are available, but are those jobs decent jobs? And so it's the tight labor market that has brought on it's a tight labor market, which is actually unusual, that has brought on these questions. Mm-hmm. And I think what a key thing all of this gets at is just the labor market is this sort of tug of war between employers and workers for who gets what share of the overall economic growth in the economy. And as the things that provide workers leverage that create that more balanced tug of war have been decimated, employers have gotten a leg up in the tug of war. I know I'm mixing all kinds of metaphors, but employers' strength in that tug of war has just dominated. And so we've seen this rising inequality in recent decades that should be mitigated somewhat in periods where the labor market is so tight that that really does transfer bargaining power, economic leverage to workers. The fact that it's taken so long to happen, even though the labor market is so tight right now, is leading to lots of really great discussions.
Yeah. So I also want to, a little later in the show, talk to you about productivity and consolidation or mergers or monopoly, the emerging monopolies we have in many sectors here, as well as forces. But Heidi, stand by here for just a quick second, because I want to introduce into the conversation Thomas Gagan. He's with us from Chicago. He's a labor lawyer and author. And author of Only One Thing Can Save Us, Why America Needs a New Kind of Labor Movement. Tom Gagan, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna. Thank you.
It's good to have you. So what do you make of what Heidi Shierholz is saying here, that we're in an era now, because of lost leverage amongst workers, that it takes historically low levels of unemployment to see an increase in wages that we would expect in similar labor markets?
Well, I think it's no surprise. I'd be much more surprised if wages had really gone up substantially, even in the tight labor market, because for decades now, you've had predictions from Alan Greenspan and Federal Reserve, gee, if the economy goes any faster, we'll have inflation. All of that assumes some bargaining power that workers no longer have. And it goes back not just 30 years, 40 years. It goes back to, well, in 1958, about 38% of the private sector was unionized. And back then, the economy, for all practical purposes, was located in the North and the Midwest. So you had workforces here in areas of this country that were 60% unionized and had huge neighborhood effects, so that if the unions raised wages 4% in any given year, and they used to set targets as to how much they would raise in a given year. You read this in the Wall Street Journal, the target this year was 4% or 3%. Then everybody else's wages went up.
So the rising tide lifts all boats notion here. Tom Gagan, stand by for just a second, and Heidi Shierholz as well. We're talking about why, even in this very tight labor market, we are not seeing wages rise as much as we might expect. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about why, even with the unemployment rate way down at 3.7%, why we're not seeing or haven't seen wages rise as much as we might expect in a tight labor market. We're joined today by Heidi Shierholz. She's senior economist and director of policy at the Economic Policy Institute. She recently wrote a paper about exactly this subject. We've got it linked at onpointradio.org. Thomas Gagan also joins us. He's a labor lawyer and author of Only One Thing Can Save Us, Why America Needs a New Kind of Labor Movement. Heidi Shierholz, let me turn back to you here for a second, because I'm just wondering, I think a lot of economists, or even just folk out there listening, might say, okay, well, first of all, we still have many states where so-called right-to-work laws are in effect that have disempowered unions. We also recently had a Supreme Court case, the Janus case, which ruled against public sector unions and has had an impact on their ability to collectively bargain for public sector employees. So there's still many, many people and influential policymakers out there who believe that who have been acting against union power. And here's why. I mean, are you suggesting that if we further re-empower unions, that that's a solution to this wage problem? Because I think perhaps some folks would say, why introduce something that that provides more friction into the system?
That's a really, really, that's a very nuanced and very good question. So I think a useful way to think about this is to step back for a second and think about the models, and I swear I won't be too wonky about this, think about the models that underlie this idea that, oh, if you pass policies that provide unions with countervailing power to employer power, that'll actually hamstring the economy, that'll hurt growth, that'll cost jobs. That has been the a narrative that economists have trotted out over and over and over again whenever policymakers have thought about doing things like passing policies to boost unions or to increase the minimum wage or whatever. They've said, no, this will actually hurt growth. It'll hamstring us. It'll cost jobs. But the key is the models underlying that logic are really, really flawed. They're models of perfect competition. And a key assumption that those models have is that workers are paid exactly what they are sort of quote unquote worth to the company. The term economists use is marginal product. But that workers are paid what they're worth to the company. The company has no power to pay them any less. They have no power to keep any of the sort of fruits of workers' labors for themselves. And so in those models, if you assume that employers have no power, then if you put things in place like minimum wages or unions that raise workers' wages, you can actually hurt growth, cost jobs. But if you open your eyes and see that, yep, actually employers do have some wage-setting power, they can actually set wages below exactly what a worker is worth to them and keep some of the fruits of workers' labors for themselves, then once you recognize that, those models do not predict that things like unions and minimum wages will hamstring growth and cause job loss. Instead, those models show that things like unions, things like the minimum wage, actually increase efficiency. And so I do think a sort of backdrop to all of this is that economists with their models of perfect competition in hand have been really complicit in pushing this idea that, you know, you boost unionization, you're going to hurt the economy. But there's been some really great research coming out recently that has just gotten at the heart of this and said, look, our labor markets are not well characterized by perfect competition. Yeah. We know that employers have a lot of power. So these policies that provide workers with some countervailing leverage, like unions, like strong labor standards, strong enforcement of those standards, that's actually really good for the economy. That's efficiency enhancing.
You know, in the future, we ought to do an hour about my constant confusion about why economists ever considered perfect competition a reality.
Love to be on that hour.
because look, I mean, there's no such thing as perfect competition in a system where we have policymakers, and we do everywhere on the planet. So, okay, that'll be a future On Point. But we got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let me just bring them in here. Laura is calling from Buffalo, New York. Laura, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
I work for a not-profit that serves young people and adults with developmental disabilities, and I'm curious about, we are Medicaid-funded, and we are actually having a very hard time retaining good workers or even just finding workers to work in general, because we can't compete with even the fast food wages that keep going up and keep going up, and therefore we are losing quality of service. And unfortunately, unsafe environments for the people that we serve due to lack of staffing. So I'm curious about any comments or if people are feeling that as well, kind of in this time of increased wages.
Uh-huh. Laura, thank you for your call. Thomas Gagan, would you like to respond to Laura? Because I feel like she's saying that in her sector, this tight labor market is actually making it hard for her as a nonprofit to hold on to qualified folks.
Well, it depends on what she's paying. You know, if you pay a high enough wage, you'll induce people to take the jobs. And there has been an increase in the minimum wage in various cities so that there are more jobs that are paying a wage that is getting people out of literal working poverty. So that's probably what she's up against.
Mm. Well, let's go to Paul, who's calling from Owl's Head, Maine. Paul, you're on the air.
I just wanted to make a comment that over the years I've worked on boats, restoring yachts, painting and varnishing, and the 15 years that I did that work, I had one raise because my employer could not afford to give me more money. And I just want to comment that there are a lot of people in this country working really hard, 40 hours a week plus, and they still don't quite make enough to survive. And it comes down to money, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But I'm just saying that we all work so hard to get our money, and if there isn't quite enough, all of the pundits can say what they say, but the reality is that we all work hard and we're not making enough money.
Right. So, Paul, don't go away for a second, because when you say there isn't enough money, though, I mean, we've seen earnings for the top 1% of Americans increase wildly. There is enough money. It's just, I mean, are you saying that it's not going to hardworking Americans like you?
Well, in my business, ma'am, the boats that I have worked on over the years were very fine old girls, and the people that owned them had a lot of money. Otherwise, they couldn't have employed us to restore these vessels to what they were years ago. And yes, there's plenty of money out there. Unfortunately, the workers aren't receiving enough.
Mm. Well, Paul, thank you for your call. So, Heidi Schierholz, this gets us straight to inequality and how that's undergirding this entire conversation as well. I mean, this is a conversation that we've been having in America for years, and we will continue to do so. But I'm just wondering, given the snapshot in time that we're talking about here, I mean, what would be your solution to address the concerns of callers like Paul?
So one of the things that Paul's comments bring to mind for me is this idea that I think when you bring up the idea, when policymakers think of, I'm going to raise the minimum wage to $15 in 2024, which is the current proposal for increasing the minimum wage in the 115th Congress, which will probably be reintroduced in the next Congress. I think when employers hear that, they picture what it would be like if they had to unilaterally just start giving their workers higher wages. And for some employers, they think that's going to put me at a competitive disadvantage vis-a-vis other employers, and I'm really going to be in trouble. But what that ignores is the fact that when you raise standards across the board, that does not affect how competitive you are compared to other employers at all. Yes, you just raise the whole floor. So when you hear a business say, oh, I couldn't afford that, it's worth thinking about, all right, are they thinking that they couldn't afford that alone? Or are they thinking of they couldn't afford that if all other businesses also face the same rules? And I think often it's just the former, and getting people to understand that when you raise the floor, then everyone follows the same rules. Workers get more money. It really is better for everyone.
But Thomas Gagan, what about... Go ahead, Tom.
I'd affirm that, too. And a good example is pensions, which you're going to talk about later, and retiree health care. So big companies look around and see company A reducing it or eliminating a pension or a private pension plan, and then they say, well, we can't compete with company A because they've gotten rid of their pensions. And there's kind of a race to the bottom, and everyone's business starts to be constructed around inputs that assume that labor costs are going to be, say, $15 an hour instead of $22 an hour. You know, the European economies, the northern European economies, are very prosperous. They pay much higher wages than we do. The wages are much more geared to productivity gains than ours. You know, it's what Heidi was talking about before. There's this neighborhood effect in terms of raising wages, and there's a neighborhood effect in terms of lowering wages. If everyone else is lowering wages, you've got lower wages.
Well, Heidi Shierholz, there's another sort of factor in this that I want to just explore here briefly, and that is that part of the theory goes that might actually hold wages down, even with low unemployment, is our sectors in which we have, if not outright monopolies, we just have very few companies, right, who are controlling the majority of that sector. I mean, interestingly, tech is a good example of that, right? We've got Amazon and Apple and Netflix and Facebook and Google, right? Maybe there's another one I should throw in there. But we have this emerging body of corporate behavior that employs, what, anti-poaching, agreements, non-compete agreements, mandatory arbitration agreements, all these things that maybe make it harder for workers, even in the highly sought-after tech sector, to move around as much and compete for higher-paying jobs. I mean, how much of that is what's at work here?
It's definitely a contributing factor. I mean, we sort of talked about this, but when you think about the thing that provides non-unionized workers with leverage is this sort of implicit threat that they could quit their job and take a job at another employer. And so if there aren't very many other employers out there, that means that threat that you could leave and take another job is much less credible, and that hurts your bargaining position vis-a-vis your employer. It just shifts power to your employer. EPI is releasing a paper later today about the effects of a proposed merger between Sprint and T-Mobile. And it shows that there's just, if that merger were allowed to go through, that would have a big negative impact on the wages of all workers in the retail wireless sector, and not just those workers at Sprint and T-Mobile. It's workers at Verizon Wireless, at AT&T Mobility would also be hurt, because when their leverage comes from knowing their employer knowing they could take a job somewhere else, and there are fewer firms now where they could take another job, their leverage just went down. So that's a key thing. And then the other thing that I just think is worth talking about here is, along these same lines, we're hearing a lot of information now about non-compete agreements. A huge share of the labor force is when they first start their job or being handed this sort of take it or leave it contract. As a condition of employment, they're required to sign these non-compete agreements. And I feel like we should all just start calling them, the word economists use is monopsony, but monopsony agreements, where it just means that there's a few number of firms. Essentially, one way to interpret it is that it's a few number of firms in the economy. And when you are signing this agreement that says you can't work anywhere else, your employer has just grabbed that power, because they've just taken away a key thing you have to secure wage increases, which is this idea that you could get a job somewhere else.
Yeah. Well, let's try to sneak in a couple more calls before we run out of time here. Alex is calling from Scarborough, Maine. You're on the air, Alex.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling to just re-emphasize, because I don't think it's emphasized enough, that college professors, people think that we make a lot of money. And the fact is there are no more tenured positions. Adjuncts haven't had a raise, at least I haven't seen a raise in over 15 years since I started teaching. And I wind up buying supplies for my students, as do many of my colleagues. We spend lots of hours outside of just the teaching part, doing lots of work that's unpaid but required. And I just wanted to let people know that, you know, education suffers because there's so many demands put on us, and we have to work other jobs in order to maintain food on the table. Yeah. $100 just doesn't go anywhere anymore.
Well, Alex, thank you for your call. I'm going to try and sneak in one last one here. Randy is calling from Burnside, Kentucky. Randy, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm a retired union iron worker out of St. Louis, Missouri, and the union's been screaming for people for the last two decades, but the point of it is these young kids don't want to put their phones down and go do manual labor. You get a pay raise every 2 years because you vote on it. That's my opinion. Thank you.
All right. Well, Randy, thank you so much for your call. Heidi Shearholz and Tom Gagin, we've just got a minute and a half left here to go. Heidi, my last question for you is, you know, you're sort of helping us understand what I think are the culmination of trends that have been going on for several decades. So I'm just trying to pull out what the new lessons are here. I mean, if we want to reverse this trend and allow or have American workers enjoy a higher percentage of the American bounty, what should we do?
I think one key lesson is that there's a lot we can do. This is not just the natural outcome of a modern economy. These are deliberate policy choices that led us to this situation of this very imbalanced labor market where employers have a lot more power than workers. And so there's tons of policy levers that we can pull, policies to increase union coverage, policies to strengthen labor standards and their enforcement, policies to do things like ban non-compete agreements. What the last caller, Randy, who talked about millennials not being interested in union jobs, I think there is some extremely encouraging polling coming out talking about the support of unions amongst millennials. I think there's just a lot more energy around this, and I am optimistic that there'll be some action taken in the next Congress.
Well, Heidi Shearholz, Senior Economist and Director of Policy at the Economic Policy Institute, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. It's been my pleasure.
And Thomas Gagin, labor lawyer and author of Only One Thing Can Save Us. Tom Gagin, thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome.
And listeners, stick with us, because when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about why an increasing number of senior Americans in their 70s and even 80s can't afford to retire. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Millions of Americans who thought they'd have retired by now are still out there holding down jobs they simply cannot afford to give up. We're talking about workers in their 70s and 80s. And if you're one of them, let us know why. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Now, one such person is Tom Coomer of Wagner, Oklahoma. He's 80 years old and works as a greeter at his local Walmart. He was profiled in a recent CBS News report, and we've got a link to that report at onpointradio.org. Tom Coomer, welcome to On Point.
How are you today?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Tell me a little bit about your job right now. How long have you been working at your local Walmart?
I'll be there 9 years in June the 15th, this coming June the 15th.
And you're 80 years old, is that right, sir?
Yes.
Okay. And so did you imagine 20 years ago that when you hit 80, you'd still be on the job?
No, I was figuring on retiring at about age 60 to 62 is what I was planning on retiring.
Mm-hmm. So why is it that you're still working day in and day out?
Well, I lost my retirement at McDonnell Douglas in 1994. They put a speaker on and told us within 60 days they'd close. And at that time, when they closed in May of 94, I had 29 years and I had to have 30 to get my retirement.
Okay, hold on for a second. So in 1994, you were working as a machinist at McDonnell Douglas, right? The aerospace manufacturer in Tulsa. And you said that one day they just put an announcement out over the PA system saying that, you know, they were going to close in 60 days, that plant was going to close?
Yes, this come over the speaker. We was all working, and all of a sudden the speaker come on and said, McDonnell Douglas will close in 60 days. I don't give you much time to get ready for losing your job.
Wow. And you said you were, at that point, you were what, a year off from having worked enough years to secure your pension?
Yes. Yes. They had what they call a 30 and out up there, and you had to be 55 and have 30 years in. And I was 56 and had 29 years in, so I missed it.
So you'd worked 29 years, but you just missed it by 1 year.
1 year. Actually, the day I got laid off, I lacked 1 year from that day of getting my full retirement.
That must have been devastating. And did you have how much savings did you have at the time?
Not a lot, because I was, like I say, I was figuring on working a few more years. And, you know, you try to get everything took care of. I had dreamed. My dream was to retire and travel and just kind of see the world, because my wife and I had raised three children and we hadn't got to do much. So that was my dream. And she kept telling me over and over, don't dream about that. Now, anything could happen. I said, no, I just like 1 year. And I've got a lot of seniority up there, so I can make it, but I didn't.
Hmm. And I see that your wife was also forced into retirement, or was...
Yes, yes. Yes, she worked at Telex Memorex, and she was trying to get her time in, but they put her out about 2 to 4 years early, too, so she didn't get her full retirement either. So it just it was just kind of like a boomerang, you know, how that happens.
Yeah. Now, I have a question for you, Mr. Coomer. In the CBS News report, they had a quote from you that I was a little confused by. They quoted you as saying, you blame yourself. Blame yourself for what?
Well, I should have been saving more instead of, you know, looking for... I was looking forward to that retirement to carry us through, so I could have really broke down and saved more if I'd have seen that coming. Not went out and ate a few times less or anything. So I kind of blame myself for it.
I got to ask you, though, I mean, were you earning enough at the time that saving more would have even been an option?
Yeah, if I'd have cut back on stuff like, you know, when you're young, you like to get out and go fishing, hunt, and all that kind of stuff. If I'd cut back on some of that, that's what I was more or less talking about.
I see. But Mr. Coomer, if I can say, I mean, I can't imagine that even saving a little bit more, would that have even matched what you'd lost in your pension?
No, I could have never matched that. I had a guy figure up what I've lost since 94, and it almost blew my mind.
I feel like you're being a little unfair to yourself, if I can be honest, because who working in a job for 29 years would have expected to hear that announcement over the PA that you were going to lose your job in 60 days?
Yeah, it affected me so hard that for months after that, I would have dreams that I was back at Douglas getting that year, but I couldn't find my time card to punch in. And that's how hard it affected me.
Yeah. I mean, I guess why I'm asking is, it doesn't seem fair. You're not. I feel like you're not being fair to yourself. You're taking on board responsibility, which maybe ought to be put on McDonnell Douglas for shutting down the company. And here you are still having to work at 80 years old. Now, I mean, McDonnell Douglas has its reasons, but taking on the responsibility for that as an individual just doesn't seem like you're being fair to yourself.
Yeah, I know. I'm a little hard on myself, but, you know, it's my nature.
So tell me, what is life like now, and how long do you think you're going to have to keep doing this?
Well, we're using the Walmart money for is like I keep our life insurance or car insurance, stuff like that would be hard to come up with out of our regular money. I keep all that paid through the Walmart money.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like, I mean, but these sound like things that you need for living.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm hoping that within the next 2 to 3 years I can get out of there.
Yeah. And you've got Social Security too?
Yes.
Okay.
If it wasn't for that, I couldn't have made it, period. I mean, there'd been no way.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm seeing here from the CBS News report that with your Walmart checks and Social Security and a partial pension that you've got, you're living around $3,100 a month, you and your wife?
Yes.
Okay. And she's got some medical needs. So are those being met?
Very bad needs. Yeah, she's got a heart problem, and she's had diabetes since she was 28 years old. So I have a lot of time with her being down, sick on me and stuff like that. And, you know, a lot of worry that way. I call her at every break at Walmart and make sure she's all right.
You call her at every break that you've got. Yeah. Well, finally, Mr. Coomer, I want to ask you something. I appreciate very much your strength and your independence. And you said you're just that way when you looked back on your past and said maybe you could have done more. But we're talking to you because there are millions of other Americans like you who, in a time where they ought to be enjoying the fruits of having worked for decades, they still have to be on the job. And I'm just wondering, what does that make you think about where sort of the country is right now that so many older Americans have to work?
Yeah, well, you know, I try not to think about that too much. What I try to do at Walmart, and I enjoy doing it, is to make other people happy as they come through the door. I've seen a lot of people come through the door, look down and out, and I'll greet them and talk to them and try to help them lift up their head. And in doing that, it lifts up my head.
All right. Well, Tom Coomer, 80 years old and works as a greeter at his local Walmart. He was featured first in a CBS News report, and we have a link to that at onpointradio.org. Mr. Coomer, thank you so very much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, let's get a quick call in here before we turn to our next guest. Mitch is calling from Tampa, Florida. Mitch, you're on the air. Do you have a story similar to Mr. Coomer? Did that ring a bell for you?
Oh, yeah, it did ring a bell, and thank you for taking my call. I was an employee of the state of Florida for 15 years. Didn't get a raise for a lot of those, and the retirement as a result is very low. And I've had to start a business of processing building permits where I go out and take care of the paperwork for a couple of different companies. And just in order to be able to keep on living, you know, and being able to do things that I want to do. An article recently showed that the salary that we were receiving wasn't even enough to be able to rent an apartment in Tampa. So
right.
Now I know why I wasn't able to save and get a little ahead.
Yeah. Well, Mitch, thank you for your call. Let's turn now to Alicia Munell. She is director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College. She served on the President's Council of Economic Advisors and as Assistant Secretary of the Treasury for Economic Policy in the Clinton administration. Alicia Munell, welcome to On Point.
Good day, Magda. How are you?
I'm doing well, although concerned about seeing these rising numbers of senior Americans who have to stay on the job. I mean, how many millions of seniors are we talking about here?
So I think Tom's situation is unique. This 30 and out is sort of unusual in defined benefit plans.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the old-fashioned pension plans, and we're moving more towards 401k plans.
Right.
So 80 is unique. But I think the fact that people are going to have to work longer is not. We construct an index that projects what percent of today's working households are not going to be able to maintain their standard of living in retirement. And that index shows that 50% will not be prepared.
Half of people.
Half of, yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm seeing here some numbers that say that nearly 10 million Americans are still working past the age of 65.
That's true.
Okay. So that's it. So that's a huge number of people. I mean, is it because, I mean, you mentioned 401ks, so a lot of the responsibility for income in retirement has shifted over the past decades away from companies and to workers. Is that part of the problem here? Because they have to deal with the uncertainty of wherever those 401ks are invested.
Well, there's the twofold problem. On the one hand, people are going to need more for retirement because they're living longer but not staying in their full-time job longer.
Mm-hmm.
So they're big, long retirement spans. And also we have high and rising health care costs. At the same time that people are going to need more, the systems that we count on for retirement benefits are going to provide relatively less. The 401k plans, we have really good numbers on how much people have in those. Households approaching retirement, age 55 to 64, have $135,000 with a plan,
right.
$135,000 in their combined 401 individual retirement account. And half the private sector workforce at any moment in time has no retirement plan at all.
Right. That's an important point to make, right? Because, of, you know, where all things are relative, at least those with a 401k plan might be a tiny bit ahead. But you're, as you're saying, there are so many people who do not. And then, you know, in the last couple of segments of the show, we were also talking about how we've seen median wages basically stagnate for several decades now. So it limits the amount that even those people who do have a plan can put into those 401ks.
And I was really touched by your caller Tom, the idea that he thinks he should have been able to save outside of his defined benefit plan. This is not realistic. People don't save except through retirement plans. So retirement plans are just crucial for people's well-being in retirement.
Yeah. Well, let's take another quick call here. Jason is calling from Dearborn, Michigan. Jason, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call on this very important issue. And I think it ties to our previous segment that we were discussing about wage stagnation and the importance of unions and how I really believe, and I think a lot of people in this country believe, that unions make capitalism possible and by extension retirement possible. When you take collective bargaining away from people, retirement as a whole becomes really unworkable and unimaginable for a lot of working Americans. I think the connection between wages and retirement security and, you know, unemployment and productivity and Wall Street valuations, the traditional economic theory, it all kind of breaks down when we take away collective bargaining. So I know I'm currently protected by a UAW contract. I'm very grateful for that. My father retired with a Teamsters pension, and now that is threatened because of valuation dips in that fund. So I went recently and talked with a friend of mine. He does financial planning.
Yeah.
And he said that the UAW workers that he sees, because we're in the Detroit area here, are in much better positions facing retirement than even people who have professional careers or even, you know, have higher salaries.
Because of those benefits secured for them by the United Auto Workers Union. Jason, thank you so much for your call. Just wanted to jump in there here because we're running out of time. And Alicia Munell, you know, I'm hearing here when you say that half we're looking at half of a future retiree is not having enough or zero in the, in 401ks or any kind of retirement savings. It also are we also looking at a future or even a present now where we have this growing number of seniors who are either on the precipice of poverty or maybe looking at a future where they will live in poverty? And I personally don't find that acceptable in America right now. So how do we change that?
So most people retiring soon will be retiring only with 401ks. And as I said, those balances are modest. Moreover, Social Security is providing less than it has in the past. So I don't think we can avoid poverty if we do a bunch of things. Tell people they really have to work into their 60s, not into their 70s and 80s, like Tom, but well into their 60s. And we need to make 401ks work as best as possible. And we need to cover the half of private sector workers who don't have any retirement system at all.
Meaning what? How would we do that?
So there are some state efforts to do it. Oregon, Illinois, California have set up systems where employers who don't provide their own plan are required by the state to put some of their employees' salaries automatically into an independent individual retirement account, and so that the employee can then opt out. But it provides some way for people without an employer plan to start saving.
Mm. Well, Alicia Munell, director of the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Oh, delighted to be here.
Well, you can keep your comments and your stories and your personal experiences about your wages and what you're looking at in terms of your financial future as you face retirement. Send those to us. We're at onpointradio.org, or you can go to Twitter or Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.